and an honor, and to be asked to come and to share with you today. And gosh, I didn't know much about Asbury a year and a half ago, period. Didn't even, maybe I'd heard the name sometime in my lifetime, but I hadn't never really connected into it. And then was invited a year and a half ago to share at Chapel in Wilmore, and from there it just took off. I love Asbury. I was actually raised a Methodist, and then went on to various denominations, eventually became an elder in the Presbyterian Church, and now I'm in a covenant church. But I'm thinking about Methodism again. I really am. And I really do come before you this afternoon with a lot to share. My heart is overflowing. And I get a little vulnerable too. So in the community of fellow believers, I found it to be okay. There's a lot of memories, there's a lot down in here that I want to get out to you today. I love the theme of this period of worship, and that's walking with Jesus to the cross, to the world. You pegged it for me. I didn't even know that was the theme until I just kind of read it here just before the service. I want to acknowledge that I knew much less about the Orlando campus until I had an opportunity this weekend to hear it presented at Marco Island, where Molly and I were for a second year, to hear James, Hugo, and I'm going to probably mutilate your name, Magallanes, to hear Zeta Perez translate for him, and how powerful that was. And thank you, Zeta, for that, and how the Lord used you in that. To hear Mary Jackson, is Mary here today? Mary, you are here. You promised me. You promised me you'd be here. And what a pleasure it was to see you and meet your husband. What a blessing you were to me. You see, I live an hour north of Seattle, and I live in a migrant community, believe it or not. We have about 30,000 migrant workers in our community. And Molly and I are involved in a ministry there called Skagit Valley Hispanic Ministries. This was all kind of a surprise to me when I found out about Orlando. So I really feel connected here. Something's going to happen here, I feel, and Steve and I have talked. We founded a seminary up there. I was in catalytic to forming a seminary called the People Seminary, and I won't go into that today. But it's about preparing people to reach out and touch the margins and connect in ways that are life-changing, in ways that those that go to minister receive the blessing. Get a perspective on that. And that's really kind of what I want to share with you today. What I'm going to share are basically three stories. The same three stories that I shared a year ago at Marco Island and have shared at other occasions. I have a lot of stories to tell from my last 10 years, principally. But I picked these two as kind of representing three geographical areas, and I think, but all representing the same sort of message, I believe. Before I get started, I want to recall for you something that happened a year ago at Marco Island, the place where I first told these three stories that I will share with you today. Immediately following my remarks, desire was expressed to gather with Molly and me to reflect upon what had been said. The response was not unfamiliar to us, and so approximately 80 folks gathered immediately then at the noon hour, followed later on that day, and throughout the next 3 days by numerous private meetings with individuals and couples. Most of whom he met with were folks that the world would call successful. They were leaders in the church, their professions, and their communities. Call them even pillars in the church, likely mature in their faith. And yet in those sacred meetings, sometimes in the presence of tears, there was a deep longing that broke through, revealed and uncamouflaged by the stories that you will hear today. A longing that I increasingly believe lies very near the heart of Jesus. So with that brief background, I will begin. I stand here this afternoon as one whose own life best witnesses to me the existence of God's unlimited grace, God's undeserved favor. Knowing what he knows about the very imperfect me, ask my dear wife. I am once again amazed at the possibility that he may be speaking through me today. The stories I share with you today are stories of that grace, stories from a journey which has taken me to the margins of the world, to places that my friend and mentor Bob Seipel, the former president of World Vision, refers to as the cruel edges of the world. It is my prayer that my stories will reveal to you something of God's nature, perhaps some new dimension of his truth and grace. Recall with me now one truth that is repeated time and again throughout Scripture. Preceding the lives of several in the Bible, there was a time spent in the wilderness, a time ordained by God to be one of preparation, a necessary space, an interlude, less cluttered, where God could redirect the mind and the heart. In February of 1994, I was having my wilderness experience. A year earlier, I had sold a third of three businesses, and since doing so, had officed at home. I felt very much out of the mainstream. I was distant from the environment that it had for 35 years defined such a very large part of my identity. I was hanging out at home. It was a time, however, when I was increasing my awareness of things not focused on me by before. World events were one. The war in Bosnia was raging, always in my face, it seemed, through television and other media were the images of the devastation and the suffering there. I connected to the location of the war. It was in 1962 that Molly and I were married and lived for 2 years in Munich, Germany, during my service in the Army. In prayer, I asked God how we could help, how we could make a difference. In my search, a mutual friend suggested that I contact a Dr. Peter Kuzmich, a Croatian, a renowned Eastern European theologian. Some of you may have heard of Dr. Kuzmich. Who does? You do. Thanks. Peter is the founder of a prominent seminary in Eastern Croatia. Excuse me. He more recently had established Agape Ministries, a series of refugee feeding stations located along the Bosnian front lines. During one of his brief U.S. visits, I was able to connect with him by phone. I told him of our desire to respond. During a second conversation, he said to me, "Don, the best way for you to determine how to respond is to go there, to see for yourself close up the suffering and the devastation." It was hardly the answer that I was looking for, hardly the one I wished to hear. "But understand," he said, "there are considerable risks in doing so, but I recommend that you take them. I'm leaving in 10 days, and if you wish to join me, I will accompany you there." "Peter," I said, "if I decide to join you, what more do I need to prepare?" In his usual direct and profound style, he said, "All you need is a passport, a plane ticket, and much prayer. Jesus will meet you there." I walked into the next room, cleared my throat, and announced to my dear wife of then 35 years that I had been invited to go to a war. Her response, equally unwelcome, was, "That's great, why don't you go?" Now, after a year of having hung out with me at home, I recall both the kids were still at home and I was making jam and generally getting in the way. It was a very confusing time. I can understand her encouragement. 12 days later, I was standing I'm okay. I was standing in a sea of refugees. It's going to be okay. And the sea of refugees on the front lines of that war. I still vividly recall the hours of being in that sea of refugees. The grip of cold hands. Good to be with brothers and sisters. Joining them around long tables for their hot meal of the day. Obviously out of place, I was presumed by some to be an authority, several with translated words, others only through their eyes. Asked for encouragement and hope. Have you seen my mother, my husband, my brother, my children? Following 3 days for Peter, I was accompanied for the remainder of my journey by Miss Chris Marshall, one of my many teachers yet to come. She is an American woman my age, a tiny woman affectionately known at that time and later through the writings of others as the Mother Teresa of Croatia and Bosnia, so named for her war-long efforts to work with the elderly and child refugees along the front lines. On a cold, wet, early March afternoon, riding between devastated towns, Chris turned to me in her knowing way and said, "Ask how I was doing." I replied that I was simply overwhelmed by the suffering, destruction, and hopelessness. I acknowledged that I had come looking for a way to make a difference, but with each hour, the reality of that seemed ever more distant. As one who by then knew my background, Chris turned to me and said, essentially these words. "I want to speak a few words of comfort to you, Don. God does not, first of all, want your money, your great ideas, or your many connections, things which are rooted in power and sufficiency. What God most wants at this moment is your presence, to lay aside control, to allow your heart to be brightened by those things which break His. And in so much as it is possible for you to do, join Jesus in solidarity with those who suffer here, those who grieve here. Learn to listen. Grow in compassion. In time, God will reveal to you opportunities to respond in practical ways. But for now, God simply wants your presence, and He wants to accompany you in it. You see." In days to come, she recalled for me the remodel of Jesus, who, though fully sufficient, humbled Himself to be present in our midst, who through His presence revealed God's love and very nature. "It was through my presence that He could do the same," she said. "Reveal it first to me, you see. And then by His grace through me to others. You see, I needed Bosnia far more than it needed me. It was there that Chris guided me to the narrow downward path that is so difficult for such as I to find. For me, its destination was the cross. It seems that I had begun my journey through the needle's eye, caught a glimpse of God's kingdom, and would never, never be the same. I returned to London, where my dear one waited. I told her best I could about who had taken place, and so to better understand, she asked if she could see what I had seen. And so the next day, we were back on a flight to Zagreb, Croatia. I remember the day landing between United Nations transporters that were bringing United Nations troops in at that time. We went back not to the front lines, but to nearby areas which were filled by refugees and lost. The region has become a place where we have since spent many, many months together. God has provided a rich circle of friends and teachers and revealed to us many things. Our lives have been reordered, as well as our priorities. And Chris was right, many opportunities have opened up for us to serve in there. A second story I tell you, 4 years ago I was having lunch at a Seattle Rotary meeting. Following it, I ran into Al York, a good friend of mine, among the best at what he does. Al is the Director of International Operations for the Christian Seattle-based World Concern, a relief and development organization. I was on its board and soon to be its chairman. "What's up, Al?" I said. "In a couple of weeks, I'm on my way to North Korea," he replied. "There's a famine there, and I'm going in to assess the needs and hopefully follow up with some assistance." After a brief pause, I asked if I could come along. The question seemed to stun us both. "Really?" he said. "Hey, Don, I'm talking North Korea. A dark and kind of dangerous place." "Yeah, I've read about it, Al, but I'd really like to go with you. I'd love to have you join me, Don, but it's a very, very long shot that I can obtain a visa for you. Last year, less than 50 issued to folks from Western countries. Just aid workers, a couple of MIA search teams. No business guys, I know. But what the heck, give me your passport and I'll see what I can do." On the way down the elevator to the parking garage, I asked Al if we could pray together, and so we did. 2 weeks later, following bureaucratic miracles, Al and I stepped off a North Korean Airlines surplus Russian jet and into the darkest place on earth. God had heard our elevator prayer and had opened yet another door to me. You see? And so while waiting to disembark, we joined hands and with whispered voices, we gave him thanks. Three officials greeted us. One of them was our translator, a man in his early 30s, his name Che Yong-il. More about Che later. North Korea. I have been asked many times to describe it. After four visits, I still lack the words. 23 million people, 1.4 million men and women, standing army, fourth largest in the world. Soldiers are the pride of North Korea and can be seen in nearly everywhere you look. North Korea is described by seasoned relief workers as the most isolated and, yes, darkest place on earth. There is one flight in and out of the country per week. I have never known it to be full. Its citizens, with the rare exception of a trusted few, have for the past 58 years had no contact whatsoever with the world beyond its borders, and no access to radio, television, the internet, or written press beyond the government's few publications. Propaganda is in overdrive. In the capital city of Pyongyang, I am awakened at 5:30 to the sound of blaring military music and triumphant anti-American messages. Kim Jong-il, the son of founder Kim Il-sung, now deceased, is their dear leader, a godlike figure with absolute authority. He leads with an iron fist. He is ruthless, and since the Soviet Revolution, Soviet military support for them has nearly vanished, and its infrastructure has crumbled. Everything is broken, it seems. Its only reliable exports are illegal drugs and weapons and counterfeit currency, some of the best in the world. And if not already, then soon to be weapons-grade plutonium, and maybe bombs. It's a country of slogans. Red and white slogans are everywhere. My translator, Che, occasionally reads them to me. U.S. imperialist aggressors are sworn enemies. Let's kill them all, reads one. During frightfully cold winters, they have spent hours in the countryside with hungry children and sick elderly in unheated homes and classrooms and orphanages and hospitals. There is a devastating famine in the land. In the last 4 years, an estimated 3 million people have starved to death. From defectors, I have had numerous reports of cannibalism. Over 60% of its children are chronically malnourished and severely stunted. 10-year-old children look like 5-year-olds. 6-year-olds look like 2-year-olds. Many no longer have the energy to even cry. They just moan or kind of wheeze. North Korea is in jeopardy of losing a generation. I have visited alternative food factories. It is there that food pellets for human consumption are made. The ingredients are ground leaves and roots and sticks and grass, and if available, a little bit of cornmeal. Especially in the countryside, fuel and heat are rare. There is almost no electric power, no lights in the villages at night, and very few throughout the city. A multitude of diseases run rampant there. I am close up familiar with the suffering and have held many dying children in my arms. And know the embrace and warm tears of mothers with no hope. I love the ordinary people, and as unlikely as it may seem, I deeply miss being with them. World Concern provides medical, agricultural, and veterinary assistance. Assessment and monitoring are difficult to carry out. Their government is afraid that our close-up encounter with the people will diminish the fear and break it down, that fear which of us that they strive so hard to instill in them. Earlier I mentioned my translator, Che Yong-il. He seldom leaves my side. He is my son's age, 36. He is very bright, speaks perfect English, fully indoctrinated, entrusted by his government. He is a future leader, I'm sure. His dream is to be the first ambassador to the United States. His father was the former ambassador to Cuba and Chile and Libya. Because he translates our every word and theirs, he is essential to the success of what we do. Che's challenge is very, very great. Because of my unique status as a businessman, I am a curio. I am unusual. There are none of me there. When I am not in the countryside, I am asked to meet with a variety of people in the government. They keep me very busy, sometimes into the night. Che is always at my side, speaking my thoughts for me. Late during my second of 4 visits to North Korea, I was sitting across a long table from several leaders, representing a variety of departments in the government. They thanked me for coming, for assisting their country and their people in the great march forward. Through Che, I listened politely to a brief, triumphant speech. And then the highest-ranking man sitting directly across from me at the table's center asked a question. As if planted in his mind by the whispering of God, "Mr. Mowat, we know that you are a businessman, that in America you have a saying that time is money, and yet you give up that time to come and be with us, our elderly, and our children. Please tell us what motivates you to do so." Parenthetically, let me give you some additional perspective. I am a walker, jogger, whenever I have a chance. And in Pyongyang, I was granted permission to take that walk at 5:30 in the morning, not alone, of course. Che was authorized to accompany and watch over me. It turned out to be a God-appointed time, I'm sure. After a few mornings out and during my second visit, I wanted his assurance that he was not recording us, as I'm always recorded. My room is bugged. I hardly have a time when I'm sure that I'm not being recorded. Che, standing proudly in the bright new Nike shoes that I had brought him, allowed me to pat him down, to confirm that it was just the two of us alone. In the several hours which we have spent together walking, Che has carefully begun to open up his heart to me, and I the same. One morning he asked if I would be his USA daddy. I told him how honored I was to be asked, and that I would be, and he committed to being my North Korean son. I have a birthday card in my Bible. Yeah, I need to bring it up from Che. I told him that I, which he gave me one day, stuck to me on the way out. I told him that I really cared for him, and he said the same of me, but we can never ever risk others knowing of this growing relationship and even love. For Che, it would likely mean the worst. I mean, the worst. I really miss him a lot, and I worry about him, but I have put him in God's hands. Please, Mr. Mowat, the voice from across the table asked, what motivates you to be here? I took a deep breath and asked God to take over, and so he did, it seemed. I answered that I could only tell them in the context of my faith, and but knew it was against their laws for me to speak of it. So through Che, I asked permission, go ahead. The answer came back to Che, go ahead, go ahead. And so I did. Peace came over me slowly and gently. I spoke roughly as follows. I told them first about a God unlikely any earthly leader, unlike any earthly leader, one who existed from the beginning and created all, and told him of our common bond as children of this God, our Father, and of how he came to briefly dwell amongst us as a man to reveal himself to us. Jesus was his name. As Jesus taught and showed us many things through his words and the way he lived his life, loving and kind, gentle, full of mercy. He taught us that he wanted us to follow him, to do as he did, and to love him just as he loved us. And then he asked that we love and care for all his other children, and especially those who suffered in the world, and I assured them that I was in their country with no other purpose, no other purpose than to do as our Heavenly Father has asked, to love and assist them and others in their time of need, and especially the little ones who have no power, and that it is the best way that I know of to express my love for my God, my Father, and for theirs. May I share with you today an amazing truth? It is as though the Word got out, you see. God has hardwired us. He's hardwired us for a relationship with Him. Sometimes it's just simply revealed to others. It is as though the Word got out. Others in the government now ask the same question of me, and then give me permission to answer, and so I do. Gently and softly, lovingly, not triumphantly, in a way that they hear. I wish you could be there. Not long after that first question, I was on an early morning walk with Che. I said to him, Che, I have no way of knowing whether you translate my words exactly. About the other night, the question about my motivation, did you translate my words exactly? My daddy, he says, I promise that I did. Your answer was too important not to. And Che's reply went into my heart. You see, I'm very, very careful and gentle with Che. I don't want to compromise him, put him in harm's way, or so for now I have not followed on with him. But I believe that God is speaking to his heart, and that his heart is listening. And God only knows what the future holds for Che. Only God knows what the future holds for Che. Very briefly, I want to share with you one final, very up-to-the-minute story from North Korea. You know, I'm running over, and if you need to leave, you leave. Very briefly, I want to share with you one final, very up-to-the-minute story from North Korea. I ask that you treat it somewhat confidentially. Early last year, I was introduced to Ambassador Han, North Korea's representative to the United Nations. We are discussing the building of a children's hospital in his country. Following meetings in Seattle, so much to tell you about that, I don't have time. Following meetings in Seattle and New York, we now talk once a week, more and more about our lives, it seems. We are becoming friends. I suspect that he doesn't have too many here. Yes, an old fish trader is better than nothing and will have to do for now. I told him that I was available to serve him. I recently arranged to get his toothache fixed pro bono by a New York Christian dentist that I knew. Mid-December, I sent the ambassador an email assuring that I prayed for him. Thinking that maybe I had stepped over the line, I wonder if I'd ever hear from him again. But it's just amazing what a little patience, kindness, gentleness will do. Seems he just doesn't know quite what to do with me. The day before Christmas, my new Stalinist friend sent me a very personal and warm email in Christmas greeting. Merry Christmas. He apologized for not more recently being in contact, said he'd been very busy with the nuclear issue. Listen to me closely. This is amazing. Could it be that I am witness to the fruit of choosing love over power? But I say to you, Jesus said, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. Are we listening? Are you listening this afternoon? Am I listening this afternoon? Are these just sentimental words to us? Like so many of the words that Jesus spoke. And to our national leaders who seek to follow Jesus in a time held captive to the sin of fear. These words of Jesus are risky and counterintuitive, yes. But imagine the potential in them. What no eye has seen, nor ear has heard, nor the heart of man can see. My final story occurred in the fall of 1999. Molly and I were midway in a 3-month stay in London. While there, I was asked to address a gathering of government and business leaders at the British National Prayer Breakfast. Following my remarks, I was quietly approached by a middle-aged man who asked to speak with me in a 20-minute conversation. I came to know that his name was Sam, that he lived in Belfast, and was a very successful real estate developer. By the standards of the world, he had it all. He described himself as a Christian, but an empty one, without much purpose beyond the next deal or other diversion from his emptiness. Relationships in shambles, isolated and disconnected. The poverty of wealth, I call it. The poverty of what the world calls success. I am familiar with it and its burdens, and know many others who are the same. Sam asked to spend some time with me. He said that he'd be back in London in 3 weeks and asked if we could get together. I replied that I'd never been to Belfast, and rather than wait for his return, I'd love to come and spend some time with him. A week later, I was occupying the guest room of his lovely home in suburban Belfast. I spent several days with Sam and his family and many hours riding around Belfast with Sam. He's showing me his vast holdings of office buildings and shopping centers. I listened to his heart late into the night. Sam said that I was safe to talk to, and so he did. Prayed together, shared scripture. These were the prayers of one who was seeking, and they revealed much about his emptiness. Before I had left London for Belfast, a dear London friend who ministers to men had given me a call. He asked if I'd stop by and see an acquaintance of his, a medical doctor named Rupert Jones. He simply said that Rupert had a dream and needed some encouragement. He joined Rupert and his wife Brenda in their Belfast home for lunch. He described a chapter from their journey. 12 years earlier, he had discerned God's call to give up a very lucrative suburban practice and instead establish one in the impoverished heart of Belfast along the Shankill Road, at the epicenter of violence and mayhem. On the Protestant side, 3 blocks west of the wall which divides this part of the city, he further described the call to be a reconciler, described a dream that Brenda and he now shared, to build a new clinic on an abandoned lot bordering the wall, closer to the Catholic neighborhood, where more of them would feel comfortable coming to be served, where the clinic could be a venue for an increasing number of divided people to mix and through God's grace find healing beyond the physical alone. After lunch, I asked if he would take me there and show me close up the location that he had in mind. He drove me to his clinic and then excitedly accompanied me walking the three littered blocks to the wall and vacant site. We went behind the wall as well. He was welcomed by a few warm greetings there from Catholics. People there recognized this kindly man. Few Protestants would or could have taken me there. As we walked and talked, I asked Rupert, "Who knows about your dream? Who else have you brought here? Is anyone assisting you? Alongside of you? No one really," he said. "Not really bankable, you know. Not close to many people from the business world. Especially any that know about developing and financing such a thing. It's risky, probably not insurable. It wouldn't make much sense to most." "Rupert," I said, "can you join me for lunch tomorrow with a friend?" So the next day, Rupert, Sam, and I gathered at a nearby pub. I had invited Jesus to. So glad that he came. You see, Rupert is now in a new clinic. Place of hope in the midst of hate. And Rupert also has a new friend, and so does Sam. Sam's new friend has connected him to joy and faith and purpose and relationship, kindness, goodness, and mercy. In ways not previously known by him, I spoke with Rupert not too long ago, and he told me that Sam just comes on by now and just hangs out in the waiting room. Me? Want to know about me? I am in awe. Simply in awe. And once again filled with wonder. Do you still have the capacity to wonder and joy? Sure sign of God's presence. Time doesn't permit, and so many other stories I want to tell you. Some from precious weeks spent with the underground church in Manchuria, a Chinese ethnic Korean church that is supported and encouraged by us at World Concern. It is comprised of a body of believers who put their lives on the line every day, body of believers for whom things hoped for, things not seen, their faith, a dependent faith, seems so much richer and deeper than my own. Along the Chinese-North Korean river border, they hide and care for the scores of thousands of illegal North Korean refugees who hide out there. If the Chinese authorities detect these refugees, they are returned to North Korea to a near certain death, either by the bullet or in one of several gulag-style labor camps. I hope to soon return to be with these dear ones and Jesus in their mountain hideouts. I must close now, but just a few more comments, and then I'm done. Acknowledging the very long road which yet lies ahead of me to full maturity in Christ, I want to describe best I can how so far, so much has changed for me. You know, there was a time not too many years ago that I approach my faith in a similar manner to the way I approach so many other things in life. Some of you may even relate to this. I worked so hard at it. I stayed so busy and tried to be the best at it. At times I got sort of comfortable and even exclusive in it.